Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of November. National Geographic is teaching us all a great deal about the mysteries, and indeed they are profound mysteries, of great migrations. It's the cover story of the November issue of National Geographic, What Guides Them into the Unknown, and it's also the focus of a seven-part series on National Geographic television, which started last night, and I was trying to take notes, but I didn't want to take notes because I wanted to keep my eyes on the television. It is just a riveting program with, I don't know how they got some of this footage, but it is just astounding. Just to see what happens with monarch butterflies is worth your investment of time on this. It is just an astounding story. Karen Kostel is our guest, and Karen's many books and articles have covered the heroics of people and animals, the subtleties of place, and the richness of ideas and aspirations that propel human behavior. Karen is a longtime writer for National Geographic, has authored books on the lives of polar explorers, war heroes, and the child survivors of war. And her most recent work, Great Migrations, is the official companion book to the National Geographic Channel's acclaimed series by the same name. In her years in publishing, she's worked as a senior editor at both National Geographic Magazine and the Geographic's book division, as well as a contributing editor to National Geographic. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I am hopeful that we'll be able to tie in with some of you who saw the show last night or who have read the magazine too, but to see what your thoughts are about the astounding footage. Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Yeah. I'm an alumna of the University of Wisconsin, so I have lots of fond memories of your part of the country.
Oh, are you? You know, yes. So many people are. It astounds me how many people. Oh, yeah, I went to school there, too. Well, welcome back to the state of Wisconsin.
Well, thank you.
At least by phone. You know, as I was watching this astounding show last night, and I will be tuned into all of them because I've always wondered about this, I wondered, how did you get the footage? Of course, you're known for the pictures and everything, but how did you get the pictures of the monarch butterflies and the crabs and the whales? And, oh, my gosh, it was unbelievable.
Well, I'll tell you that this, you know, it is really groundbreaking footage. And a lot of that is owing to both the science and the technology of the kind of camera work we have now.
Oh.
But really, the science has changed so much in so rapidly in the way we can study these animals. You know, in the past, scientists were left with just attaching small tags to animals one by one, and we can talk about that when we talk about monarch butterflies. But the Geographic work really closely with the scientists who understand this to just come up with something that I don't think anyone has ever seen before.
No, to watch a butterfly become a butterfly was just one of those moments that made you think, oh, the
kind
world
of amazing,
is something.
Isn't it?
Absolutely amazing.
But there are lots and lots of amazing stories in this book. I was really, in just writing it and working with the National Geographic Channel people, seeing what they were getting, just you started to think like an animal, I think. You really got on the level of an animal, and you understood the world they live in a little bit better.
The show last night looked at wildebeests and red crabs and monarch butterflies and whales. Is there something common among all of those animals, that there's something imprinted on the DNA that tells them, whoops, it's time to go and here's how you do it? Or what is it?
Well, that's another thing. Science is studying and making some real breakthroughs on. And with the different animals, we're finding more and more that they're different ways, they're different clues and cues they get to move, but they're also different things that guide them. And it's very sophisticated stuff. A lot of these animals, like the monarchs, have magnetite in their brain. So they have a geomagnetic, where they have the ability to read the Earth's geomagnetic fields and use that or field, I should say, and use that to guide them as they start the migration process. And while they're in the midst of it, I mean, these animals cover huge distances, and you know, they don't have a GPS to guide them.
Right.
So we're using GPS in terms of studying them, but they use that. They use ultraviolet light, the quality of light at a given moment to decide it's time to migrate. They often use odor, and they even have visual cues. They have a memory of the landscape they're, let's say, flying over.
They use the sun, the moon, the tides.
All of that. They're really sophisticated in their ability to read the earth. More sophisticated, certainly, than we are without the help of machines.
Right. So let's go to the monarchs first, because they're so gorgeous and their journey is so long. And I had no idea, Karen, involves several generations.
Yes, it involves four generations.
Wow.
And it's really a generational odyssey. And the sad thing is, there's one thing all of those heroic monarchs need to make that journey, and that's milkweed. And there's less and less of it left in the U.S. But just to trace that journey a little bit, they winter over, as most people know now. The eastern group of monarchs, they're two different migratory groups, but the eastern group winters over in Mexico, and I'd love to talk in a few minutes about how that discovery was made, the actual place they winter over, that everybody knows now, but it was unknown until the last few decades. But they come out of Mexico all at once. They go into the southern U.S., the Texas area, and they start laying eggs, and generation after generation successively makes their way up the plains. They loop around, and they come down the East Coast. And I now live in the Blue Ridge area of Virginia, which is another major spot for monarchs. It's kind of the last generation is coming through here. And we see less and less of them.
Hmm.
That's because they need milkweed to lay their eggs on. And there's almost no milkweed left, and I took it upon myself to plant a little this fall. So I'm hoping I in working on this book, and I hope when people see the series that's premiering in the next week and read the book, they'll really start to feel more than just, well, as the producer, David Hamlin, said, it's not just looking at these animals and saying, aren't they beautiful? You know, when you see a skein of geese go by or the monarch butterflies, but saying, wow, I'm really rooting for you, because they need you to root for them now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sure do. So what's happened to the milkweed?
Well, the milkweed needs, when the plains were kind of empty and there were fewer and fewer, there was less and less development, fewer farms, more roadsides that remained unplowed. The milkweed is opportunistic. It's really a weed, and it spread itself. And as we have cultivated land and as the human footprint has increased, there's just less and less milkweed for these animals to lay their eggs on. They have to have the milkweed to lay their eggs on. So that's really, especially on the east where I am, that's the big fear now.
So we need to plant more milkweed.
Plant more milkweed. Don't cut it down. Have fallow meadowland. And I don't honestly... I'm not an expert on milkweed, but my understanding is it doesn't need great soil to survive in, but it does need to be left alone.
Okay. All right. Well, we can accomplish that. We can plant more milkweed here.
Great.
In Wisconsin.
Please do.
Yeah. So how did you discover? Tell us the story of how you found where they actually winter.
Oh, it's a great story, actually. There was a Canadian... Let me just say, because probably a lot of your readers have heard about the monarchs wintering in the Pacific Grove area of California, and that is the western group of monarchs. We're talking about the eastern group that I just explained their migratory path. And a Canadian entomologist named Fred Urquhart just became obsessed with finding out what happened to these these wonderful creatures during the winter. Everyone had assumed that they wintered somewhere in the Caribbean, but no one had found that spot. And he came up with a very small tag that would not in any way harm the monarchs or keep them from making this migration. And he enlisted just lots of volunteers to go out and tag monarchs. And they did this, and the tag had his name on it, and I think a phone number, as I recall. The idea was if people found the monarchs with the tag, with their tag, they would call and let him know where they'd spotted these monarchs. A couple started to be spotted in Mexico, and he went, and a guy who was an American expatriate living in Mexico, a motorcycle buff, discovered that there was one town in a fairly remote part of Mexico where these, where a couple tags had been recovered. He let Fred know, and Fred and his wife set off to visit this place. It's high up in the mountains, very remote. They got into the woodland in a you know, difficult area to get to. They're walking through steep slopes, woodland, and they come across just literally millions
of
butterflies.
Oh, what a sight.
It was really quite a story. And it was, you know, it's the endurance of these scientists. This Tuesday, the next sequence in the series that's premiering is on the science behind this and what these scientists do to find out about these animals. It really takes patience, often sitting and observing, going into, you know, putting your life at risk, really, to follow these animals. Imagine what it's like to try to see a creature that, that lives under the water all the time.
Right.
And what it takes to study those
right.
kinds of movements. If I may I tell you one other little story?
Oh, you can tell me whatever stories you want.
Well,
yes.
A scientist that I just had the pleasure of meeting last week, Rory Wilson, has pioneered something called the Daily Diary. Very, very small. Almost like a tiny battery chip, the kind of thing you would use in a cell phone or something. And he's an animal behaviorist, and he had been studying penguins. And he realized one day as he was watching, observing penguins on shore, thinking, well, okay, I can see these animals in my environment, which is land, but they live here very infrequently. They spend a very little bit of their time here. I want to see them in their environment, underwater. And he started working on this small device, and it can measure so many things so quickly, light, movement, energy expenditure, that it's just revolutionizing the way we can study, especially marine mammals, but also I think he's been using it as well, if I'm correct in this, on, you know, bird life. And penguins are bird life, but other marine mammals have been tagged with these devices. And he also told me that he has used it on humans. And he's learning a lot about the emotional state of a person from moment to moment with his daily diary. So it's a long, long way from Fred Urquhart getting a lot of volunteers to go out and essentially put a small piece of tape around a monarch.
Mm-hmm. And before we move on to some of the other animals, I find this hard to believe, but is it true that these monarchs, I think the film said this last night, go 900 hours of flying if they're in, say, the Midwest to get back to Mexico? 900 hours?
These animals can make amazing journeys. Well, that group, that last generation, is coming out of the southeast of the U.S.
I see.
And that group kind of goes nonstop. It's using, there's a lot of also science behind how they do that, and they're using thermal currents. They also, they seem to be able to kind of read the airways and know when the winds are going to help them in their flight. And they don't want to expend a lot of energy, and they don't want to be so heavy with pollen, with nectar, sorry, that they can't sustain themselves in flight, because just carrying a load costs more energy. So they really kind of configure the energy coefficient, how the winds are blowing, how much they need to load up on nectar, and how that's all going to work for them to do the amazing flight you just talked about.
And sometimes to return, this just astounds me, to the same tree.
Yes. Yeah. It's astonishing, isn't it? I'm just, again, I think with this this push by the Geographic to bring migration to people, to give them the animal's eye view of what it's like to make these migrations, is really, it's changed my thinking.
Yeah, it has mine too. I'll never look at I don't see too many sperm whales or red crabs, but I'll never look at a monarch in the same way, that's for sure. I have even more respect for them, the ultimate respect for them. Karen Kostel is our guest. She is contributing writer for National Geographic, and she is author of Great Migrations, which is the official companion book to the National Geographic Channel's acclaimed series by the same name, and that's premiered last night. If you go to the National Geographic station, they have, it's the first in a series of seven programs on great migrations. And last night looked not only at monarch butterflies, but it looked at sperm whales and wildebeests and red crabs and other animals. So there will be different animals covered, and we'll ask Karen to give us a rundown of what the next episodes will hold for us. But it's pretty spectacular viewing. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, starting with Jan from Delafield. Hi, Jan.
Good morning.
Hello, Jan.
Oh, sorry, I can barely hear you. Are you okay?
Yeah, we're okay. I don't know what kind of phone you're on, but you sound real hollow.
Yeah, it's kind of odd, isn't it?
Well, anyway, go right ahead. We can hear you.
Great. We, from the time our children were very small, they would pick, as they called it, the caterpillars off the milk queen along the lakeshore and bring them home, and we'd watch them go into their cocoons and come out in the spring and just loved it. And as the milkweed started to disappear there, I brought it home and planted it in the yard, and they've snubbed us ever since. We can see them come into the yard, we can see them sip at the flowers, but apparently they don't think much of the child care because they've never laid their eggs there.
Well, I'm really glad you're planting milkweed, Jan, but I really can't tell you why they would not like your yard.
Maybe this year, Jan.
Well, I've been doing it for 15 years. I won't stop just because I haven't attracted them yet, but we'll keep trying. Thanks.
Okay. But can I ask you, Jan, you do have the monarchs in your yard, right?
Oh, absolutely. We can see them come and sip at the flowers and float around, but they, as I said, they don't seem to lay their eggs there.
Well, I still think you're doing something right, and you should keep it up. I'll try to talk to some of the monarchs I know and see if I can get them to lay their eggs in your yard.
We have an email from Bonnie saying, please let everybody know that they don't have to plant the common milkweed to help monarchs. There's a beautiful plant, butterfly weed, which is orange, and it grows in dry to medium soil. The red milkweed is also great and requires a bit more moisture. I grow both of these plants, and nurseries in Wisconsin sell both of these. So a little more information. Before we exclusively talk about monarchs, I just want to let people know that there were other animals, migrations, that were highlighted in last night's show. This was extraordinary footage, too. Christmas Island with the red crabs.
Yep, they're amazing, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
You have this island that suddenly comes alive. It's volcanic. And all of a sudden, it's crawling with these really determined animals heading down off the slopes and into the sea. And so many of them, it's not a long, by world standards, migration, but it's really a heroic one. And a lot of these animals, the females especially, don't make it back. The young, often, they go through all this work, the mothers, and in fact, a lot of the young don't make it. Only on some years when all of the kind of elements are working together do you get a good new generation of these young red crabs.
And let's talk about the ants that they encounter who blind them with poison, and the ants really shouldn't be there.
That's right. They're an introduced species, and that happens so much in so many places of the world. You know, humans introduce something, or in the case of these ants, it was inadvertent, came in on shipping to Christmas Island. So as you see this happen in various parts of the world, you understand just how subtle the human footprint can be. You know, you bring in a species that comes in on a cargo ship inadvertently, and it changes the landscape for other animals that have survived in a specific area for eons.
Yeah. And is that, we haven't seen all of the series, I just saw last night's series, but is that kind of a theme that the areas that are needed in order to accomplish migration are being threatened pretty severely by either human encroachment or by climate change?
It really is a theme, and it's a frightening theme, because what there's so many ways actually that we are changing the landscape. It's not always in ways you anticipate, but sometimes it's very inadvertent, and one that, you know, I think about when I think about particularly Wisconsin is it's a good story, and that's the story of DDT. You had this situation early in the 20th century where DDT, overhunting, all kinds of things, had just decimated bird populations. So bald eagles, peregrine falcons, even Canada geese. The great Canada goose was almost extinct, if you can believe it, in the early 1900s. Now people see so many of them, they think they're a nuisance. But in fact, you see a wonderful comeback along the Mississippi Flyway where you're seeing peregrine falcons nesting, as well as bald eagles, lots of Canada geese, all kinds of birds. And I just think that story is a positive one, but it wasn't as if we humans started using DDT because we wanted to get rid of Canada geese or bald eagles. So that's one way we very much can impact the natural world. And then just what our visible footprint on the world, development, what we were talking about with milkweed. The other thing is putting up boundaries. A lot of these animals need a specific migratory corridor to follow. The Mali elephants, amazing creatures, are so threatened by more and more human encroachment right in the line of sight from the one area they need to get to the pasture land that is green and allows them to survive during the dry season. And if humans get in the way of that, it just doesn't work for them. Mm-hmm. And they're another wonderful grand species or grand group of elephants that are being really threatened now. But there are more and more of those as we impact the world more. The oceans, the acidification of the oceans, what happened in the Gulf. That happened just as I was completing the book, and I was holding my breath. The migratory birds were going to be affected. This other wonderful thing called the deep scattering layer, which is a group of microscopic plankton that comes up and down the ocean chain, comes from about 1,500 feet below and comes toward the surface every evening. It makes a migration. And this is, you know, the top of the food chain, the bottom of the food chain. This is what the larger fish, animals feed on. And if that gets impacted by something like oil or the chemicals used to disperse it, you don't know what's going to happen to the whole food chain.
Mm-hmm. So we don't exactly know what will be happening with the migratory birds. Do we have an indication now as a result of the spill?
Well, right now I think things are looking much more positive than what we had thought they might be when we were really afraid that just the brown pelicans, who are struggling to survive, could go away from all this. But right now it's looking more positive. But I really think just last week they found, there, you know, scientists found an area of dead coral that they are now attributing to the spill, perhaps. I think that's, they're still waiting to decide on that. But I think it's all about, it's always a wait and see. These things, the effects of them are just more complicated than what we can perceive quickly.
Right. Let's go to Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kathleen. Back to the butterflies. Whenever I see a butterfly flitting along a busy city street and there's nothing for them to eat for miles around, I just wonder how long can that butterfly go without eating anything?
Well, I think, again, some of these butterflies, I don't know the migratory behavior of all butterflies. And I, you know, we all love seeing them in the yard, as one of your listeners just wrote in saying that they're at our bushes, they're eating that way. But again, they're making, if they're localized, I think they're just opportunistic feeders. They're feeding on whatever is natural to them. But when they're planning this migration, they're calculating the load they need to carry to get them where they're going. So I think it's very much determined by what they're about to do, what they're doing, what stage they're in their own development, and what's available.
Yeah. Well, if they're counting on something being there that one year or something, you know, that's not there the next year, what would happen to them?
Well, with the milkweed, what happens is the eggs are laid on the milkweed, only on the milkweed. What to get into nature, red in tooth and claw, the monarch females try to lay only one egg. They want to make sure that their egg on the milkweed is the only one on it, because, in fact, if there are two caterpillars roaming the same milkweed, they will eat each other. That happens, too. There's some cannibalism. But it's the caterpillars that eat the milkweed, and that's what's so critical. The adult butterflies are sipping nectar and doing other things, but it's the laying the egg on the milkweed so the caterpillar has something to eat as it develops and goes into the next stage of development. That's the part that's really, really critical.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, very much for your call. Isn't it remarkable that this creature, which looks so delicate, has to be constructed so that it's not all that delicate? It can withstand winds and these incredibly long flights. And they're just little butterflies.
I know. It's really something. And, again, it makes me think of what the thing I said David Hamlin, the producer of the series, said, which is, these creatures, you know, you just, now I don't see them and say they're beautiful. I think, wow, I'm rooting for you. And I think, you know,
right.
I think I feel that way. So also in the book, one of the creatures I was most taken with are the army ants, another creature that's very small. We don't see them here. This was the area we were filming in was Costa Rica.
Mm.
And in the book, I wrote about the people who had studied them and how the amount of sophistication these animals have. You know, they're really E.O. Wilson, the very, very famous biological evolutionist, has said that these animals outlasted the dinosaurs, and they're going to outlast us if we should stumble.
Goodness.
They work together so that they're almost like one organism. Thousands of little ants moving together as if they're one body. And they've managed to perfect almost what it's like to be a social creature. Another scientist who studied them, Ian Cousins, says we humans haven't evolved in the societies we currently live in anything like the ants in terms of our ability to cooperate and get along and ensure our own survival.
Ooh, there's a talk show. Really, isn't it? We haven't.
Yeah,
I like that idea. What about the number of animals? And this was particularly true of the crabs and the wildebeests that were featured in the program last night, so many of them, I mean, huge numbers of them die when they're making this migration. What's that all about?
Yeah, you know, it's true. And especially the young. They're often...
Right, the babies.
Yeah, yeah. I will tell you that your viewers will definitely want to see... They'll want to see it all. But to really understand what went on and some of the backstory of making this, some of what happened to the filmmakers themselves, there's some pretty harrowing scenes with them.
Ooh.
But there are also harrowing scenes with the animals themselves in the final the final show in this series, which is called Behind the Scenes. And that will be airing next Sunday, this upcoming Sunday. We've got two more major shows premiering, and those are The Race to Survive and, let's see, The Race to Survive is coming up on Sunday, and so is Feast or Famine. I can go over a bit if you'd like me to.
Sure.
What's going to be covered in those?
Sure.
And then those two end, let me say, with behind the scenes thing that will really let your viewers have a sense of what it was like to make this. But coming up next Sunday in the premiere for Feast or Famine, the Mali elephants will be covered, great white sharks. Everyone wants to know about great white sharks. In writing about them in the book, I changed my mind completely on those as well, and they're very admirable creatures. And we know so little about them. One thing that's not covered in the series, the television show, but is in the book, is this thing called the Shark Cafe. In the Pacific, sort of between California and Hawaii, for reasons that scientists have no idea of, great whites congregate in a place in the Pacific as they make their migration. And what's going on there, nobody knows yet, but again, it's been dubbed the Shark Cafe, so more to come on that.
Why do you think what are the possibilities?
They don't know.
They don't know.
It's a feeding issue. It's really unclear. What we show in the book and in the upcoming premiere is sharks off Guadalupe Island in Mexico. Why they came there, we've now realized, is to feed on the amazing marine life that comes there, including seals that make their own incredible migration to come and breed at this one spot. And as you say, there's a lot of death involved because they get there and the great whites are waiting for them.
Yeah.
But also in that same Feast or Famine segment that will be airing this Sunday, you'll get the Mississippi Flyway in the Wisconsin Driftless area. So do stay tuned for that. That's right in your backyard. And then that will be followed by the final major segment on the animals, which is Race to Survive, and that will cover the amazing journey, the Pacific walrus, very threatened animals because of what's happening in the Arctic and the melting of the ice. Mm. But we'll follow them. They from ice flows, they leave the area in the Bering Sea, and they move north into the Chukchi Sea. I'll say this, I hope I'm not sounding too prejudiced, but it's the women who are taking care of, or I should say the females, taking care of the young walrus. That's the case with a lot of these animals, and they're the ones that are really struggling to survive. You'll have to read the book to find out why it's particularly difficult for them with the disappearance of the ice. But we'll have those. We'll have the pronghorn antelope in Wyoming who make their own migration, one small herd programmed to go from the outside the Wind River Range in Wyoming into the Grand Tetons. And there's so many obstacles in their way now. They have to cross highways, and these animals keep at it because it's in their genes to make this migration.
They have to do it. And fences. There are fences, too, right?
There are fences. It's what they do to do this migration they've been doing for probably thousands of years is pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all pretty unbelievable, the whole series. We welcome more phone calls in just a moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the National Geographic Multimedia information series on the Great Migrations. Our guest this hour is the author of Great Migrations, which is the official companion book to the National Geographic Channel's acclaimed series by the same name. I saw last night's was the premiere last night, and then there will be many more on Sundays. Karen mentioned it Tuesday, too. We'll have to make sure that we have our schedules down so that you can see these. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Karen Kostel is our guest, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Victor in Milwaukee. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guest. I was served in the armed forces earlier this year. I was in January. I was stationed in Iraq, probably northwestern Iraq, and I saw something you would unexpect there. I saw squadrons of ravens. That's the first time in my life I saw a raven. I thought it was a crow at first, and I said, this thing's too big to be a crow. Hmm. Yes, it was a raven. So I think they was getting ready to fly down to southern Iraq because I just saw like hundreds of them. And it kind of was scaring the way because I started thinking of the movie The Birds. And I
yeah,
said, well, these turned down and attacked us. We in trouble.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I have to say I love your language, squadrons of ravens. That's a great way to describe them. And that's about all I can comment on because I really don't know the behavior of ravens in that part of the world. But beyond being fearful of them, was it kind of an exciting thing to see?
Oh, yeah. I just said it in general. I liked them. They were interesting. Matter of fact, I got a funny anecdote for you. We were in a formation, right? And somebody in our formation told a joke, and we laughed. Within a minute, the raven started laughing. So they're smart birds, too.
Oh,
I love that.
Oh, yeah. Must be good to be home, though. Even if there are
nice
no ravens.
Oh, yeah, be seeing green and rain and moisture around instead
right.
of the brown of the
yeah.
desert. So it was an experience, but I'm glad to be back home.
Yeah. Thank you, Victor. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Your
All
call.
Right.
Terry in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Terry.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to put a plug in for the National Geographic special as well as the book. I think that as many parents as possible and grandparents should read as much as they can and learn as much as they are able to learn about these complex creatures throughout our planet, including the monarch, its copycat viceroy, other insects and animals, the migration phenomena. And then as they study these complex creatures and learn as much as they can about how complex these creatures are made, then ask themselves the question, which takes more faith, to believe that these things came about from an intelligent design, or did they all just come about by random chance?
No. You want to comment on that, Karen?
Well, thank you, Terry. I think when you look at these creatures, each of us have our own reaction to them, and they are remarkable. It's hard for me to actually say whether or not how you're going to react to these animals. I know how I see it, and I just see each of them as their own sort of miracle. So I think I'm glad you're inspired by them, and I hope that everyone takes your advice and does read the book to their kids. And look at the pictures in the book. You can tell the kids the stories of these animals, and they can, you know, they can have some time in the book to just dig in and look at what the pictures in the book. They're, you know, we had still photographers on assignment, so you're really getting a close up look at these animals and find their own way and experience of marvel as they look at the natural world.
And it is. That's a good word to use because that's what you do when you see this. You marvel at it. And they are. These animals are so complex, aren't they? It just, oh my gosh.
It's kind of mind-blowing. And I, you know, I haven't mentioned this, and I should. The National Geographic November issue had major coverage of great migrations in it, and a wonderful article by David Quammen, who's a superb writer, that goes over the science behind migration. And that's not to be missed as well.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the pictures. I'm looking right now at this picture of sandhill cranes at the Platte River in Nebraska, and it just takes your breath away. There are so many sandhill cranes.
I know. Oh. I know. Another animal that people feared had gone away from us. So, again, there's so many stories like that. I think last night you would have seen the white-eared cob migration in southern Sudan.
I didn't see that.
An example of an animal that people thought no one had any idea. There was a huge migration to rival the wildebeest of the Serengeti going on in southern Sudan, an area of the world that's been very war-torn and almost, you know, because of the war, the human footprint changed in a strange and ironic way. There's thought that this actually helped the cob reestablish their migration routes and flourish in that area.
Huh. Thanks, Terry, so much for your call. Valerie in Cross Plains, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I'm glad you're having this program because somehow I missed this last night, and it's one of the things I can watch with my 9-year-old that'll drag him away from his cartoons and stuff.
Right.
But what I wanted to mention quickly is that there is a website called, I think it's called monarchwatch.org, where you can go and actually watch a wave of the monarchs as they move across the country in the spring. And they'll tell you how to set up what they call a monarch way station.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. That's great.
And what to plant and to encourage them. We had quite a few on my swamp milkweed this summer, and I think we saved some lives since you told me that they cannibalized because we took a few and put them in jars and raised them into butterflies and let them go. But that was also a wonderful experience for my son to watch them change.
MonarchWatch.org?
MonarchWatch.org.
Monarch Watch.
Great. Go on there. They will tell you how to set up a way station.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. You mentioned the white-eared cobs. I'm interested in having written the book and seen this series, are there animals that you maybe didn't even know existed that are doing these extraordinary migrations that you want to let us watch out for as we watch the series and read your book?
Well, I think white-eared cob is a great one because just the discovery of them and their migration is pretty earth-shattering because it was just so unknown. And here are many thousands of animals, you know, making this kind of long, as far as we know at this point, and there's just, the science is just coming to bear on them now, but a migration they've probably also been doing for hundreds of years at least. So to just follow them and see what they're doing and how they're finding ways to survive in the current situation is really something. I was also taken with the whale shark, which is off of Belize. It's a large filter feeder animal, so it's not the kind of shark that the great white is. And it's feeding on this deep scattering layer I mentioned, this plankton that comes up and back and forth to the surface of the ocean every evening. And reading about those animals, how they're surviving, that's an animal I didn't know about before, frankly. Knew nothing about the deep scattering layer, which wasn't even discovered until radar came to be used in the Second World War. And when the radar operators were monitoring what was happening in the ocean, really for warfare purposes, they started seeing this movement every night, and they called it the false bottom. They thought the bottom of the ocean was moving up and down. So that fascinated me as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Valerie, very much for your call. Let's go next to Joan from Milwaukee. Hello, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wondered if you realize that there's a weigh station for Monarch right here in Milwaukee County on the county grounds.
Really?
Well,
and,
that's great.
It's near the buildings on Watertown Plank Road.
Sure.
And toward Highway 100.
Okay.
And there is a lady named Barb Agnew with wildflower flowers on 124th and Watertown Plank Road, who's trying to save the oak trees that they rest in and the feeding area, which is full of those weeds that you were talking about.
Milkweed?
Mm-hmm. Milkweed. And UWM is hoping to build an engineering school there, and Wauwatosa is okaying giving them, you know, tax breaks to move out there, and people are going to be building roads. And so she's trying to protect at least some of this weigh station.
Great. Mm-hmm.
And that's where we can see monarchs and learn more about them.
I didn't know this. Thank you so much. And there has to be that kind of balanced discussion going on all over the world, Karen, doesn't there?
I really agree with you. Absolutely. And I'm just sitting here feeling kind of sheepish because, as far as I know, in Virginia, which is a site for the monarch migration, as I said, at the last generation, I don't know of any monarch way stations. I know that one of the most famous monarch, the leading experts on monarchs, Lincoln Brower, is in this area. So he may have set up such a thing, and I wish I could tell your viewers that we had been as active in Virginia as they've been. But I'm inspired by what's going on in Wisconsin.
I am too. It's amazing what goes on in Wisconsin and how people listen to this, and you just have information all over the place.
It's wonderful.
It is wonderful. Now, the series, just give us some nuts and bolts here. Is it on just on Sunday nights? You mentioned it Tuesday a few minutes ago.
No, this coming Tuesday, tomorrow.
Okay, all right.
Will be one of my favorite parts of the series. Actually, I like them all. I shouldn't say that. But it's the science of migration. Some of the things I was talking about, the daily diary tagging that Rory Wilson developed first to study penguins but has put on so many animals, that will be featured, and various other tagging devices that take us into the world of these animals. So stay tuned for that this Tuesday, tomorrow night, on the National Geographic Channel. And then next Sunday will be the final pieces of the series, which is Feast or Famine, I had mentioned, with various animals, Race to Survive. One segment of that I didn't mention is there's beautiful footage of animals collected around a giant fig in the Borneo rainforest. These are amazing trees, and they attract all kinds of animals when they're in fruit. And you're just up in this canopy in the air, watching these animals do their acrobatics, fight with each other for figs. It's just a great thing to see. Yeah. And then finally, again, the final bit of this is premiering next Sunday after those two segments, and that is behind the scenes. And you really do want to watch how these cinematographers manage to get the footage. There are some great stories there.
Oh, I would imagine. You could tell from looking at yesterday, how did they get this footage? What did they, the crab, how did you get that footage?
Interesting you liked the crab, because David Hamlin, the producer, the one, he was in the field often, but not for every single one of these takes. But he did say that the one thing he wouldn't miss was, he wanted to see was the red crab migration. So that had captivated his interest long before he began this series.
Yeah.
I should also mention that the National Geographic's cover story, well, I do think it is the cover of the National Geographic November issue.
Yes.
And the David Quammen article really has some wonderful information in it that isn't covered in either the book or the channel series.
Yeah, so just learn as much as you can. You've got all these places to go. Thank you so much, Karen, for being with us. It was a great hour, and congratulations on the book, and the series is phenomenal. It's great.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it was great to be talking to Wisconsin again.
Yeah, I'm sure. Karen Kostel, contributing writer for National Geographic and author of Great Migrations, which is the official companion book to the National Geographic Channel series by the same name. The next one, the behind the scenes, is Tuesday. That's tomorrow, right? Tuesday. Okay, well, that was fun. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Here's to the Great Migrations. We'll be with you tomorrow at 9.